Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. The election is over. So this week, we thought it was only fitting to share a few stories, tall tales, and flat-out lies without the political pressure. Like this one by nationally known storyteller Susie Waples.
Grammy, you wear thongs at the beach? And I'm like, well, yes, everybody does. I mean, I know that when you first start wearing them, they can rub a blister. But.
And what about some friendly childhood competition by Bill Lepp, also an award-winning storyteller and author?
And I said, so remember, because I like to say useful things to my children, remember, if nobody wins, everybody's a loser.
You'll find these stories, some whopping lies, and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Well, the election is over. So as a gift and a relief and, hey, maybe even a satirical gesture, we thought, let's celebrate liars. After all, here in Appalachia, we have a rich cultural tradition of storytelling. We'll be featuring storytellers from the West Virginia Storytellers Guild, all of whom have competed and won prizes across the country. So to kick things off, how about a story about a thong? Susie Waples hails from Dunbar, West Virginia. She told this next story at the National Storytelling Festival in Jonesboro, Tennessee.
Oh, thank you. You know, I believe kind of what goes around comes around, or there's really nothing new under the sun. They just bring it back with a new name. Like the other day I was down shopping and I saw a hula hoop, only it was called an exercise ring. And I was buying some new pants, and the girl said, do you like these capris? I said, honey, when I was in school, they were called pedal pushers. And the kids are just crazy about flip-flops. You know, they wear them everywhere. When I was in school, they were called Zoris or thongs. Y'all remember that? You remember? Well, I had promised last year to take my two oldest granddaughters to the beach, and they are just a joy. And one of them was 17. That's Emily, my oldest granddaughter. And the other one's 14, Stephanie. And so we're at the house and I'm making this list of everything I got to get to take to the beach. And I like, you know, like beach towels and sunglasses and sunblock. And, you know, isn't that funny that we go to the beach to block the sun? Anyway, and so I'm writing this list and I say, Emmy, honey, you got any thongs to wear to the beach? And she just kind of sits there for about half a minute, and then she goes, no. And I said, well, I have to get you some. And I said, Stephanie, honey, you got any? And she's like, no. And I said, thongs are wonderful. They're perfect for the beach. I mean, I wouldn't go without mine. And Stephanie says, like, Grammy, you wear thongs at the beach? And I'm like, well, yes, everybody does. I mean, I know that when you first start wearing them, they can rub a blister. But. But after you get used to them, you don't can't even tell you got nothing on. And if you get sand in them, honey, all you got to do is walk down the edge of the water, take them off, rinse them out, and put them back on. They're perfect. Well, my girls both turned a funny color. And they excused themselves and went upstairs. And they were up there for about 15 minutes. And Emily come back down, Stephanie following her, and Emily said, Grammy, you know that I love you with all my heart, don't you? I said, of course, and I love you the same. And she said, and you know I would never, ever hurt your feelings for nothing. And I said, oh, I know that, baby. And she said, but Grammy, could for this summer while Stephanie and I are with you, could you just not wear your thongs at the beach? And I said, well, for goodness sakes, you girls are so silly, but if it means that much to you, I will not wear my thongs at the beach this year. And they looked at each other and went, oh. And they started back up the stairs. But before they got out of earshot, I said, I'll tell you what, I won't wear mine, but you'll never convince your papa not to wear his.
That was award-winning storyteller Susie Waples, who lives in Kanawha County. We'll hear more from her again at the end of the episode. But coming up next, we'll hear a story about this one time that Bill Lepp and his friends tried to catch his bicycle on fire. That's on today's special Liars episode of Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We'll be right back.
Well, let me tell you people what a liar will do. Always coming up with something new. Steal your heart with a false pretense. Make I like he's your bosom friend now. If you don't want to get in trouble, if you don't want to get in trouble now, if you don't want to get in trouble, then you better let that liar alone. When everything's in a perfect peace, here come that liar with his deceit. When he gets his business just fixed just right, then that liar's gonna cause a fight. Now, if you don't want to get in trouble, if you don't want to get in trouble now, if you don't want to get in trouble, then you better let that liar alone.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
That song you heard at the break was by Bill and Becky Kimmons. They sang it this summer at the Vandalia Gathering Liars Contest in Charleston, West Virginia. By the way, our producer Roxy Todd was one of the judges of the Liars Contest, along with Bill Lepp and Adam Booth, two storytellers we'll hear from in this episode. Today, we're sharing stories from famous Appalachian storytellers. This next story is about first loves and flaming bicycles. It's told by a man from Charleston, West Virginia, who was called a side-splitting funny man by the Smithsonian Center for Folklife. Here's Firebike by Bill Lepp.
We were sitting at the top of Weatherwood Hill. Weatherwood Hill is the hill that I grew up on in some of my stories. And Weatherwood Hill is about a mile from the top of Weatherwood Hill to the bottom of Weatherwood Hill. And for the first third of the mile, it was almost straight up and down. And then it sort of flattened out as it went by Claridge Circle. And for the last third of the mile, it was even more almost straight up and down than the first third of the mile. And at the bottom of the hill, there was a curve. And when I was a child, we would have called it something like Dead Man's Curve. But now we know that children are much too sensitive for that sort of language. So now we would call it something like Wicked Timeout Curve. And if you missed the curve, you went off the road, and there were about 12 trees, and then there was a cliff, about a 14,000-foot cliff. I went to look at it the other day, and something's happened, because now it's only about 3 feet, but it was 14. When I was a kid, 14,000 feet. And at the bottom of that cliff, there was a pool of inky black liquid that our parents told us never to touch. They said if we touched that liquid, it would eat the flesh off of our bodies. Because you have to understand that Charleston, West Virginia, for about 40 miles going down the Kanawha River, in the 70s and 80s, there was nothing but chemical plants. And all of those chemical companies back then were environmentally conscious. And by that, I mean they were conscious that the environment was there. And that was a great place to dump waste. And all of that waste went down and collected in the pool at the bottom of that cliff. And our parents told us if we ever touched it, it would eat the flesh off of our bodies. And they told us never to go swimming in it, because if we went swimming in it, we would awake the mer creatures that lived at the bottom, and they would rise to the surface, mermaids and mermen, and they would eat the flesh off of our bodies. And we thought, well, that doesn't make any sense, because you told us the liquid would eat the flesh off of our bodies. So by the time the mer creatures get out there, there'd be nothing left to eat. Those poor mer creatures, they must be starving to death. But we left it at that. So there we were, on top of Weberwood Hill. We were sitting on our bicycles. We were getting ready to ride our bicycles down Weberwood Hill. And the goal was to ride all the way down the hill, never touch your brakes, be in 10th gear by the time you got to my house, which was the fourth house down the hill, and pedal the entire way down the hill. And the reason we wanted to do this is because we thought if we pedaled hard enough, we could build up enough friction on our sprockets that we could set our chains on fire. And the reason we thought we could set our chains on fire is because Nora said we could. Nora was a girl in our neighborhood. She was the smartest girl in the neighborhood. She was the funniest girl in the neighborhood. She was the most talented girl in the neighborhood. She was the most beautiful girl in the neighborhood. She might have been the most beautiful, talented, funniest, smartest girl in the whole world. But I don't know. We hadn't been to the whole world. So I can't say, and I don't like to generalize. I don't mind exaggerating, but I don't like to generalize. And we were right at that age where boys start to think to themselves, well, if girls have cooties, maybe cooties aren't such a bad thing to have. So when Nora said things like, if you paddle hard enough, you can set your chains on fire, all the boys in the neighborhood said, uh-huh, Nora, you're pretty. We'll do it. And that is not something that boys ever outgrow. Now, to be completely honest with you, I didn't want to set my chain on fire. I just wanted to know the kid who set his chain on fire. Because when I was growing up, whenever I was about to do something stupid, my dad would rush into the room. So you're probably thinking, well, when did he have time to get anything else done? That's not nuts. Whenever I was about to do anything stupid, my dad would rush into the room. He'd be like, no, 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 never cut glass with scissors. He'd say Dan Carlisle tried to cut glass with scissors. The glass broke. Dan cut his hand off. He was never the same afterwards. Or Dad would say, no, 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 never tie your sled to a moving car. Dan Carlisle tied his sled to a moving car. The car stopped. Dan didn't. He hit his head. He was never the same afterwards. Our dad would say, no, 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 never put a slug in your ear. Dan Carlisle put a slug in his ear, ate his brain. He was never the same afterwards. Now, I could never follow the chronology of poor Dan's life, but I know for a fact that he was never the same afterwards. So I didn't want to set my chain on fire. I just wanted to know the kid who set his chain on fire. And my chief candidate was a kid named Elmore Lofink. Now, Elmore, you have to understand about Elmore. Elmore played T-ball for 2 years. Now, just in case you're not familiar with T-ball, it's a lot like baseball, except there's nobody pitching the ball. There's a stand on home plate that is about as half as tall as this microphone, and they take a baseball, set that right on top of the stand. There's a little rubber piece on top of the stand. The baseball goes right on top of that stand, and then the batter comes up, stands there, swings, and hits the ball. The ball is not moving. It's not coming at you at 90 miles an hour. It's not sinking. It's not sliding. It's not corkscrewing. It's just sitting there. 2 years, Elmore played T-ball. Never got a hit. He bruised and battered the air above the ball. He sent the little rubber thing under the ball over the second baseman's head on several occasions, but the ball just went thunk. 2 years. He got held back. He had to play remedial T-ball. And in our culture, that's more embarrassing than getting held back in school. Now, when I took my kids to play T-ball, you know, the coaches were very specific. They said, okay, when we play, there's no outs. Everybody on the team gets to bat every inning, and we don't keep score. First of all, the kids are keeping score. Second of all, I told my kids, well, when I played T-ball, there were three outs. You got three outs every inning, and not everyone got to bat. And if you got a hit, you went to first base. And then you went to second base if you advanced, third base. And if you got to go all the way around the bases and came back and touched home plate, we called that a run, and somebody made a mark in a book. And at the end of the game, one team would have more runs than the other team, and we would call the team with more runs the winner. And I said, so remember, because I like to say useful things to my children, remember, if nobody wins, everybody's a loser. You shouldn't encourage that. So Elmore graduated from the baseball arts to the bicycling arts. And of all the people that wanted to set their chain on fire, Elmore most wanted to set his chain on fire, and I was perfectly willing to allow him to do it. And the reason Elmore most wanted to set his chain on fire is because of all the boys in the neighborhood who had a crush on Nora, Elmore had the biggest crush. Elmore wanted to date Nora. He wanted to stand beneath her window with a fiddle and serenade Nora. He wanted to write her love poems. Nora, Nora, how I adore you. And then he wanted to be engaged to Nora. He wanted to marry Nora. He wanted to have 1,000 children with Nora and spend the rest of his life with Nora. And Nora did not feel the same way about Elmore. Nora thought that if she had to spend the rest of her life with Elmore, maybe they could be neighbors if there were a couple of houses in between. But Elmore was certain that if he could set his chain on fire, he could win Nora's heart. So Nora said, go. And we started off down the hill. Now, we were not wearing safety gear. I was the last generation that could go out and play properly. When my mother said, go play, she meant, go put yourself in harm's way. When I was a kid, you know, shortly after breakfast, your adult would say to you, go away. And you were not expected home until the lights came on for supper. And if you said to your mother before you left, okay, mother, I'll go, but can I have a box of matches and a stick of dynamite? Your mother would say, well, be careful with it. We were what Andy Offutt Irwin calls the bicycle generation, which means we could go anywhere in the world on our bicycle so long as we were home for supper. If you wanted to go to Chicago and shoot pool in a smoky blues hall, nobody cared as long as you were home for supper. And people didn't wear safety gear. Only 4 kinds of people wore safety gear when I was a kid: professional football players, construction workers, firemen, and astronauts. If your job did not include purposely running into another human being, having an I-beam dropped on your head, running into a burning building, or re-entering the atmosphere. If you wore safety gear, you were sort of a wimp, and that's all there was to it. I mean, think, not even hockey players wore helmets back then. This was a wide open time. And then when my daughter was little, I was putting her on that seat on the back of my bicycle, so I put her helmet on and her little glove so she wouldn't rake the flesh off of her palms should she go sliding across the asphalt, and her elbow pads and her knee pads and her shin guards and her Kevlar vest. Until all you could even see that she was a human, she just had this moon face sticking out. And I put her on the seat and I strapped her in and I went to get on the bicycle and I swung my leg and bam! I kicked her right in the face. Now, only place I could have hurt her. Not, let's be clear, not on purpose, you understand? That didn't even really happen to me. I read that in Reader's Digest. But I liked it, so I stole it, and that is how you cite a source. Plus, we didn't need safety gear because we had something the children don't have today. We had something called tough skin blue jeans. Tough skin blue jeans were made by the Sears Roebuck Corporation. They were made from DuPont Tribond 490 polyester. They had reinforced knees. The sales slogan was, "Your children will outgrow them before they wear them out." I am the last of five children. I did not own a piece of clothing that was new until I was 28. And so when I got tough skin jeans, they were hand-me-down, 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 hand-me-downs, and still you could not bend your knees with those reinforced. Everybody walked around the neighborhood like they had just peed their pants. And the thing about tough skins was they came in myriad colors, but the dominant color was a deep, dark shade of blue that we called peed your pants blue. So you never knew which kid had and which kid hadn't. But those things were bulletproof. You could be going down the highway at 80 miles an hour in the back of a pickup truck and your dad hits a bump, one kid goes flying out, hits the asphalt. That child would be fine if they were wearing tough skin blue jeans. And they just kept from their hip to their ankle on the asphalt, they just slide across the asphalt until they ran out of steam. The only thing that could possibly go wrong is if you had one of these little metal rivets and sparks started to come off of it. If you were beside a tanker truck and the tanker truck was leaking, it might explode. But you would be fine. Well, no, you wouldn't. You would be gone from your waist up and your ankles down. But anything covered by the tough skin jeans would be fine. So Nora said, go. We're going down the hill, pedaling as hard as we could. You're probably asking yourself, how could you pedal a bicycle if you had reinforced knees that you couldn't bend? Don't overthink the story. We got to my house. I was already in 10th gear. I was trying to remember, front brake, back brake, front brake, back brake. Because if you're going down a hill that's almost straight up and down at 712 miles an hour and you hit your front brake, what's going to happen? You're going to cartwheel. You're going to look just like Colonel Steve Austin at the beginning of the $6 million man when he's coming in for that horrible landing. Already kids were chickening out. You could hear kids like, oh, I believe I hear my mother calling me for the noon repast. I must return home. So kids were just falling off by the wayside. And I was looking for dogs. Now, I'll tell you why I was looking for dogs. Because my father said to me, you have to be very careful on those bicycles because those tires are razor thin. And if you are going fast enough and you hit a dog. Now, this is one of those things that adults say to children that seem like a good idea when they leave the adult's mouth. Like, we're just standing there. You've seen adults standing around. We got our back against the wall and we're just kind of like, And then an idea will blossom in our head like a tulip. A little idea will bloom in our minds and it'll be like, I'm a good idea. I'm a smart idea. Find a young person, share me with a young person. So we go and we find a young person. We're like, young person. And the idea starts down through our head and it's like, smart, smart, smart. And it comes into our mouth, smart, smart. And it comes out of our mouth, smart, smart. And about halfway between our mouth and the young person's ear, that idea goes dumb, dumb, dumb. So my dad said to me, watch out for dogs, because those tires are razor thin, and if you hit a dog, and I know he meant be careful, don't hit a dog. He said, if you hit a dog, you will cut the dog in half. And then all I could think was, I want to hit a dog. And it's now that I don't like dogs, I love dogs, but maybe it could be a rabid dog, sort of an Atticus Fitch thing, you know? Go read a book. And Dad meant if you hit a dog in the side, I wanted to hit a dog in the nose and see if I could just split it right down the middle. So I'm going down the hill. Elmore was right beside me. Nora was a little bit behind us. Nora couldn't set her chain on fire because Nora didn't have a bicycle. Because when Nora was born, we never knew why, but her legs had never worked. So she had been in a wheelchair her whole life. But she was the kind of kid that when she said to her parents, I am going to ride my wheelchair down the hill, they did not say, gosh, Nora, I think that would be a poor idea. Because they'd known her whole life, and they knew that she was gonna do it anyway. So when she said stuff like that, they said stuff like, oh, Lordy, we better go take a welding class. And so they had welded her this wheelchair, this beautiful wheelchair. It was made out of steel pipes and steel beams just welded together. It looked like the inside of a NASCAR race car. It had a plexiglass windshield, nets on the side, a steering wheel, big fat off-road tires, a seat with a 27-point harness system, and a handbrake. And because she couldn't set her chain on fire, she just had lengths of chain hanging out from behind her wheelchair that would slap into the ground, great arcs of sparks just flying up behind her as she went down the hill. But because she had to rely on gravity, she was a little bit behind us. And we got down to Claridge Circle, where everything sort of flattened out, and now more kids were chickening out. Oh, I believe I'm having mechanical difficulties with my bicycle. I must pull to the side of the road. So by the time we got to that last part of the hill, that last third of the hill, the only people that were left were myself and Elmore and Nora just a little bit behind us. And as we started down that hill, I could smell hot metal. And I did not want to be on fire. I looked down to see if my sprocket was glowing or if my chain was on fire, but nothing. Everything was just as it should be, but I still smelled hot metal. It was like standing next to a radiator. So I looked over at Elmore's bicycle, and Elmore's sprocket was glowing bright red. It was almost molten. There were heat waves shimmering off of it, bouncing off his tough skin jeans, going up into the atmosphere, burning a hole in the ozone layer. And then all of a sudden, whoosh, 80 feet of flame shot out from behind his bicycle. It was like the afterburner on a jet fighter. And he was so excited, he was screaming, I'm on fire! I'm on fire! And he turned to Nora. He said, Nora, I'm on fire for you! And the symbolism was lost on us, but there it was. And I started to break. Back brake, front brake, and Elmore started to brake. Back brake, front brake, and then shoo, Nora shot in between us, 712 miles an hour. Something had gone wrong on her wheelchair. Her brakes didn't work. She was going down the hill. She couldn't stop. There was no way she was going to make it around Wicked Timeout Curve. She was going to go off the road, through the trees, off the cliff, into the pit, and we didn't want that to happen because we liked Nora, but I didn't know what to do. And then Elmore did the bravest thing I've ever seen in my life. Elmore let go of the brakes on his bicycle. He started to pedal as hard as he could, and I had to find out what was going to happen, so I let go of the brakes on my bicycle, and I started to pedal as hard as I could. And just before Nora went off the road, when all that was separating her from certain doom was that thin white line on the edge of the road, Elmore did a move that spawned the X Games. He whipped in front of her on his bicycle, grabbed his front brake as hard as he could, stood his bicycle up on its front wheel, wiggled his hips, which caused his bike to spin in a great 360-degree arc. His back wheel hit the front of Nora's wheelchair and sent it rolling back up the hill. Here was a child who could not hit a baseball. Sitting stationary in front of him on a windless summer afternoon, who had just rotated his burning bicycle to knock a wheelchair back up the hill. And I jumped off my bicycle, I grabbed Nora's wheelchair, and I kind of ran it to a stop. Elmore jumped off his bicycle, and the three of us were just there over Elmore's bicycle. It was just laying there, like a head with its chicken cut off. And we watched it burn, breathing the asphalt fumes, which goes on to explain a few things. When it was all gone, and there was nothing left but some aluminum ash and some bubbles in the asphalt. When it was all gone, Nora looked up at Elmore, and she said to Elmore in that tone of voice that only girls can use. It's a tone of voice that girls can use that can make boys do anything. She looked up at Elmore with a twinkle in her eye, and she said to Elmore in that tone of voice, she said, Elmore, you can push me back up the hill.
That was award-winning storyteller and Appalachian funny guy, Bill Lepp, sharing this story called Fire Bike. Bill lives in Charleston, West Virginia, and is a 5-time champion of the West Virginia Liars Contest. Well, from bicycles to roller skates, here's another tall tale about childhood and that feeling like you're on top of the world. Here's award-winning West Virginia storyteller Adam Booth telling Rollerama.
Now, I wasn't a particularly athletic child. I wasn't a big child. And I wasn't a very lucky child. So it took me until I was 11 years old before I won anything in my life. And this is that story. Now, when I was 11 years old, my home at 210 West 9th Avenue was in a row with all the other homes in our block. And if you went behind those homes, there was a railroad track just across the alley. And if you crossed the railroad track and went down a block and a half, there was Rollerama. That was our neighborhood roller skating rink. Now, I grew up in a poor family, and we didn't usually have the money to go over to Rollerama. But on Tuesday nights, you could get in for a discount, only $2. And every now and then, my family could manage to save up enough money to give me those $2 so that I could cross the railroad tracks, go down the block and a half, and there was Rollerama, with a glass window on the very front with a semicircle cut out of it. And behind that window, a tall, bald man with a big nose and a mustache that would move when he talked. Give him the $2 for discount night, and he'd give you a ticket. You go in through the door that led to a hallway that was very long, and at the end of it, one hanging, flickering light bulb that seemed to move all on its own. At the very end of the hallway, two Texas-style swinging doors that we would slam our hands like this, bam, and they would fly open, and there was the lacing lobby at Rollerama, and kids were in a frenzy all over each other, trying to put their skates on. Now, over here, there was a counter on this side of the lacing lobby, and behind it, the same tall, bald man would appear, and you would go over and tell him your skate size, and he would go in the back and pick out skates for you out of a crate, and then come back to the counter and bend double, leaning all the way over to give you those skates. And the rental was part of the $2. Over on that side of the lacing lobby, there was another counter, and behind it, a very pretty young woman stood. And we were always attracted to that counter. Not because of the pretty young woman, we were still little children. We were attracted to it because of the smells that came from behind this counter. Pizza, corn dogs. And when you went over there, there was a little window built into the counter and you could see candy bars lined up behind it. And right on the corner of that white countertop, there was a tall, crystal clear barrel-shaped jar filled with kosher dill pickles. And I love kosher dill pickles. But as I mentioned, I came from a poor family and never had the money to get a pickle. I had the $2 to get in. I would get my rental skates and sit on one of those long wooden benches there in the lacing lobby. These were the pews of our roller skating church. I sat there, and there was a bench built in underneath of it. Take my shoes off, put it under. And in the 80s, when I was a child, our roller skates were holdovers from the 70s, and they came up all the way to your knees. And they were rental skates, and the laces were frayed at the end, so you'd have to lick your fingers and rub them around the ends, and then go up 30 pairs of eyelets all the way to your knee. And when you got to the top, there was still this much lace left over, so you wrapped it around your shin and did a big bunny ear. Then the other one all the way up, and it seemed to take forever, and all your friends were out on the roller skating rink, but finally when you got them laced all the way up, you could step out of the lacing lobby onto the worn wooden boards of the roller skating rink with the first powerful push. And then we were going around and around, faster and faster. And out there, you realize that the $2 didn't just pay for your admission or the skate rental. The $2, most importantly of all, bought freedom. Now, hanging from the ceiling of Rollerama, there was a great big board about a foot thick, this wide, that tall, and it was divided up into 9 different rectangles. And each rectangle had its own light bulb inside of it, and words painted on the outside. And normally, this light bulb was lit up, and when it was lit up, the words shone and said, "All skate." We were flying around that rink. But sometimes that one went off, and this one over here turned on, and it said, couples only. And I was never on the rink for that one. Sometimes this one down here turned on. It was even worse. It said, ladies' choice. And I was an unathletic, small, scrawny, geeky kid. And none of the ladies ever chose me. But sometimes this one would turn on, and it was my favorite. Because when this light bulb turned on, all the other lights would dim down to complete darkness. They would turn on a spotlight that shone a beam of light onto a disco ball right there in the center. And light would reflect off of it, dancing all around every wall of Rollerama. And the music would turn on. Bum, 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 ba-dum, ba-dum. Dun, 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 da-dun, da-dum. And the tall, bald man with the mustache would skate out to the center with a pair of poles that had pegs going up the side. Dun, 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 da-dum, ba-dum. Dun, 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 da-dun, da-dum. And the very pretty young woman from the concession stand would roller skate out. Dun, bum, bum, ba-dum, ba-dum. And crown those poles. Dun, da-dun, da-dum, ba-dum. With a wooden bar. And all the kids in Rollerama lined up behind it. At the very end of the line, after 20 or so kids, was me. Shorter than all the rest. And everyone lined up to play because if you were the winner, your prize was a coupon for one free concession. And I could look past that line of kids, past the poles with the pegs and the worn wooden boards, the lacing lobby right there to the corner of the concession counter where there was that crystal clear jar filled with my prize. And it started. Bum, 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 ba-dum, ba-dum, one by one. Dum, bum, bum, ba-dum, ba-dum. They went under. Dum, bum, bum, ba-dum, ba-dum. Dun, dun, dum, ba-dum, ba-dum. Dun, da-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum. And then it was my turn. Dun, dum, dum. Da-dun, da-dum. Dun, da-dun, da-dun, da-dum. And then there were 18 kids left. And they moved the bar down a few pegs. Dun, 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 da, dum, da, dum. Dun, da, dum, ba, dum, ba, dum. One by one. Dum, da, dum, ba, dum, ba, dum. Everyone took their turn. Dum, 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 da, dum, da, dum. Until it was my turn. Dun, da, dum, da, dum, da, dum. Dun, dum. Dun, da, dum, da, dum. Dun, da, dum, ba, dum, ba, dum. And then there were 9 kids left. Dun ta dum ta dum pa dum, dun ta dum pa dum ta dum, dun ta dum ta dum ta dum, dun 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 dun, dun 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 dun. Forward was harder. Dun da. But I could do it. Dun da dun ta dum, dun ta dun ta dun ta dum. And then there were 2 kids left. And they moved the pole down so far that it looked like it was about 1/2 foot off of the ground. And I was first up. And at this point, it was time for the secret move. Which, if you grew up roller skating, you knew. You took your ear and put it over on your shoulder. And then you did a half split in the same direction, down as low as you could go. Like that. You would reach your other hand out below your skate because they were 4 square wheels and there was room between the sole and where the wheels were. You could grab onto the bottom of your foot there, ear on your shoulder, half split, hand under your skate, grab on, take the deepest breath you could, and breathe out behind you for propulsion to get you going. And I was heading towards that bar. I saw the poles. There was a crowd out in the lacing lobby cheering me on. And as I got closer, I could see over top of the bar still. So I squatted down even lower. It was time for shallow prayers at this point to things that were popular and small back then. Dwarves, smurfs, gnomes, things like that. Help get me under that pole. And as I got closer and closer, I was running out of steam. Right as I got there, and my head hit the bar and it fell off. hitting the rink several times and rolling away. And I stood up and skated off of the rink and collapsed out in the lacing lobby and turned just in time to see Claire Pinson win. She was also really little, just like me. My eyes glued to my feet. The shame sank from the ceiling. I was that close to winning. And then I heard this voice from over my shoulder. Hey, nice move out there. I looked over my shoulder. It was Claire. I didn't want to talk to her. She had just beat me. Thanks. And I looked back down at the ground. And then her hand came over my shoulder and grabbed onto my hand and pulled me up and across the lacing lobby to where the concession counter was. She reached down into her pocket and pulled out that coupon she had just won and reached it way up and slid it across the counter. And that pretty woman came over, opened the glass jar, and pulled out one pickle. She gave it to Claire, and Claire used her little hands to snap it in half and shoved half into my hands. Said, here. And Claire and I shared a cool, crisp, crunchy, kosher dill pickle. And then someone said, hey, look! And the all-skate light bulb turned off, and couples only turned on. And she said, come on, let's go. Grabbed me by the hand, pulled me out there. And around, and around, and around we flew. And that's the story of the first time I ever won anything in my life. Thanks.
That was storyteller Adam Booth. Adam grew up in Calhoun County and now lives in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. He's won numerous awards as a storyteller, educator, and musician. For our final story, we're going to hear another tall tale from Susie Waples. It's called Chicken Man. She told this story at the National Storytelling Festival just after describing a time when she had a terrible nightmare.
You know, it's no wonder I had such a terrible dream, because in West Virginia, just about every one of our towns has some kind of a haint or a haunt or a ghost or something. I mean, down in the bottom of our state, southern part, there's a town called Lewisburg. If you go there, they got Civil War soldiers marching through their town at night. Or over on the east side, over at Harper's Ferry, you could see the ghost of John Brown himself. And then over on the other side, there's a town called Point Pleasant. They have something called the Mothman. You might have heard of him because they made a movie about him. The Mothman was, he was kind of a mixture of a man and a moth. Kind of looked like a great big supersized butterfly, only ugly. And he had that whole town terrorized. I mean the whole town, all 53 people. They were terrorized. But you know, come think of it, we haven't heard from the Mothman for quite a few years now. I figure by this time he's had time to get to Jonesboro. Right in the middle of our state, we got a place called Flatwoods. It's in Braxton County. One time, a flying saucer landed there. Don't laugh, it did. 3 people saw it. And it let out this big monster that everybody saw. 16 of them. And this monster, it had big red glowing eyes. Actually, it kind of looked like a real supersized Palmolive liquid soap bottle with red glowing eyes. My Uncle Norman see the flying saucer once. He did. He's out on the farm. He's in the field. And he said that thing just flew around and around and around his farm. He said he just stood there for the longest time and watched it. He said finally it flew right over his head and stopped. Sent down this beam of light, sucked his brains right out of his head. You know, after that, he never had no sense at all. Didn't have no thinking power. I mean, he just had an awful time. He just couldn't concentrate on nothing. Couldn't even put two and two together. He was a regular idiot. So he got a job working for the government. Not to be outdone, we had a monster up our holler one time. It was called the Chicken Man. It had our whole holler just terrorized, it did. See, what it would do, it would wait until way late into the night when everybody up the holler was sound asleep, usually about 7:30. And it would call somebody up on the telephone. And cluck. We was all scared of being pecked to death in the middle of the night by an outraged chicken. And then people started seeing the Chicken Man. One evening I was walking up the holler from a Tupperware party at Orphy Cavender's, and that thing jumped right out in front of me, looked me right in the eye, went, "Back!" Just went flopping off. Like to scared the snot out of me. I never knew dirt could move so fast under my feet. Of course, come to find out it weren't no monster at all. It was old man Bussy. He had taken a pair of his long johns and glued chicken feathers all over it. 53 perfectly healthy chickens give their life for that chicken soup. There ain't nothing uglier in this world than a 350-pound man in a chicken suit. That is, unless it's his 450-pound wife. Old man Bussy and his wife, they've been married for years. He's crazy about her. He was. She's huge. She's a big old woman. Way bigger than me. She's a big old woman. But he didn't care. I mean, she was so big. She's so big, if she'd have fallen down, she'd have rocked herself to sleep trying to get back up. But he did not care. He loved her. Oh, he loved her. He called her his little dumpling. Of course, up the holler, we just referred to him as chicken and dumpling. When them two would get into a squabble, the feathers would fly. You talk about foul language. Of course, it's no wonder. How'd you like to be cooped up with a woman like that? We never could figure out why Bussy would want to be a chicken. My sister said she reckoned it was because when we was all little and went through them childhood diseases, well, with Bussy, the pox left, but the chicken never did. But you know, soon our troubles was all over, because that old ornery dumpling, One time, she decided to go to a roast down at the Friars Club. And there's a feller speaking there. He hailed from down in Kentucky, and he was opening a chain of restaurants in our area. They called him the Colonel. And afore you know it, Dumplin' had sold chicken to the Colonel for a paltry sum. And we never heard from him again. I think that's sad. I really do. I never could figure out why Bussy would want to be a chicken. I mean, not a chicken. They're so stupid. Do you ever see what a chicken does when you chop its head off? They're so dumb, they don't even know when they're dead. Thank you.
let me tell you, sister, if you only knew what a certain somebody done said about you.
Studies up a lie, he tells it so smooth, you think absolutely that it must be true. He urged you out to trace the tale. You don't mind, you'll be put in jail now. If you don't want to get in trouble, if you don't want to get in trouble now, if you don't want to get in trouble, then you better let that liar alone.
So we've heard plenty of nostalgic stories, tall tales, and a few whopping good lies today. You know, my dad once told me that there were two kind of lilies out there, and we were part of what they call the line lilies. He said they called us that because us line lilies, we were good salesmen and good storytellers. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from the West Virginia Storytellers Guild, Susie Waples, Bill Lepp, and Adam Booth. On our website, we've posted more information on upcoming live events and storytelling conferences here in West Virginia and in Tennessee. Music in today's show was provided by Dinosaur Burps, Bill and Becky Kimmons, Andy Agnew Jr., and Ben Townsend. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Our editor this week is Glynis Board. Our audio mixer is Xander Alloy, and we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter @InAppalachia or @JessicaYLilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And that's no bull.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education and more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.